Welcome to the Delmarva Almanac. Each week we connect you to the best of Delmarva. I'm your host, Dana Kester McCabe. This week we're dipping into our archives. We'll hear the history of one of the most venerated arts organizations on Delmarva, the Rehoboth Art League. In honor of this week's epic World Series, we'll hear some Eastern Shore baseball history. And now that cooler weather is here, it's time to get out and hike, so we'll have Jim Rapp's story about local Rails to Trails projects. When I first moved to Delmarva as a young artist, to a person, everyone I met who heard that I was a painter said, "Oh, you must go see the Rehoboth Art League." Rehoboth Beach has been a beacon to artists on Delmarva even before 1938, when, according to the newspaper The Wilmington Star, a group of art luminaries attended the dedication of the recently renovated studio cottage of the Rehoboth Art League. The organization had been formally formed the previous fall and already had over 200 members. The core of the group were artists from Wilmington who summered at the Delaware shore. For years, the famous illustrator Howard Pyle of the Brandywine School had had a cottage there, where his students, including N.C. Wyeth, had visited. Ethel Pennewell Brown, another Pyle student, also had a cottage in what was then known as the Pines. Ethel was a Wilmington native who became a successful illustrator mainly for women's magazines. She married relatively late in life, at the age of 44, to William Leach, who was also an artist. They lived in Fredericka and spent summers at Ethel's place near the beach. Ethel was apparently good at organizing things. In 1928, she got together with other artists living or working nearby and began holding exhibitions at what was then known as the Village Improvement Association on the boardwalk in Rehoboth Beach. She believed that her summer home was the perfect spot to form an artist colony. Not only was it a beautiful place to work, but it attracted its own market of tourists wanting souvenirs to remember their stay at the beach. Artists Eugenia Eckford Rhodes, Betty Harrington MacDonald, Jack Lewis, and Howard Schroeder all agreed. Another pivotal member of the group was Louise Corcoran, wife of Colonel Wilbur Corcoran. She, too, was an accomplished artist and organizer, having helped start the Delaware Art Museum in Wilmington. She also held art classes for the vacationing wives of teachers from a Middletown prep school. You're listening to the Delmarva Almanac. I'm Dana Kester McCabe, and we're talking about the history of the Rehoboth Art League. By the 1930s, just north of town, one of the first planned communities in the region was being developed by Colonel Corcoran. He was an architect who had an interest in colonial history and heritage preservation. His wife Louise and her artist friends convinced the Colonel that what the community really needed was a place to hold art exhibits, classes, and other creative events. Colonel Corcoran had purchased 200 acres of land. There had been a working plantation there as early as 1675. Somewhere in the middle of the property was the historic Peter Marsh Homestead, a cypress-shingled house which was built in 1743. Some say as a base of operations to search, albeit unsuccessfully, for the treasure of pirate Captain William Kidd, who had operated in the area. By the time Corcoran bought it, it needed a great deal of work. He gave the artist group 2 full acres and set about renovating the homestead, whenever possible using materials from other condemned buildings of the same period. An old farmhouse was moved from another location, and this became the painter's studio. These buildings evolved into the Rehoboth Art League and became the center of the community, which is now known as Henlopen Acres. At the grand opening, the widow of Howard Pyle signed her name to the studio door. The others in attendance followed her lead, some adding small pictorial flourishes. Ethel Brown added a lotus blossom. A well-known cartoonist of the day, Earl Chesney, drew a captain's hat and pipe. It's interesting to note that since that time, almost 300 artists, notable locals, and guests have signed those doors. They have now been taken out of regular use and are preserved for display. The Beaux-Arts Costume Ball was begun in 1939 and served as an annual tradition and fundraiser that was continued for more than 50 years. Throughout the next decades, the Rehoboth Art League became the social hub of the area. During the war years, Navy seamen serving nearby liked to attend their classes, dances, and parties. There were birding trips and flower shows. Their surrounding development attracted other creative types and intellectuals who bought property there because of the reputation of the artist colony and the Corcoran's marketing of it for that purpose. Since then, there have been additions, renovations, and many classes and art exhibits. The Rehoboth Art League maintains a large membership of artists nearby and from around the world. The League now has a satellite exhibition space in downtown Rehoboth Beach on Route 9. They also recently created a climate-controlled storage facility to preserve their growing collection of visual art. They have work by Howard Pyle, League organizers Louise Corcoran and Ethel Pennewell Brown, and many others. If you want to learn more about the Art League's legacy, Dr. Jan Haynes Gilmore has written two books, Doors of Fame and Ethel Pennewell Brown Leach, Delaware Artist of Time, Place, and Season. You can also read Louise Corcoran's history of the organization, Sand in Your Brush. But the best way to learn more is actually to visit the Rehoboth Art League for yourself. While you're there, you'll be inspired by the art they continue to make and exhibit there. Today and tomorrow is their 27th annual Holiday Fair and Fine Craft Show, with over 25 artisans exhibiting and selling their work, including jewelry, glass, ceramics, painting, woodworking, and wearable fiber creations. Tickets can be purchased at the door. And through November 27th, they'll have their members juried abstract show. Find out more about the Rehoboth Art League, get a link to their website, and learn about other cultural events this fall, all on our website, delmarvaalmanac.com/arts. It's time for our first break now. When we come back, we'll hear about Delmarva's baseball history. The Delmarva Almanac is brought to you in part by the following towns where the arts are flourishing. In Maryland, visit Centerville, Denton, Ocean City, Princess Anne, and Stevensville. And in Delaware, visit Dover, Milford, and Rehoboth Beach. Visit our website for links to their galleries, eateries, and arts-related events. That's delmarvaalmanac.com/artstowns. Welcome back to the Delmarva Almanac. I'm Dana Kester-McCabe. In honor of this week's epic World Series between the Chicago Cubs and the Cleveland Indians, here's a story about our own baseball history right here on the Eastern Shore. It has long been debated whether the rules and the creation of the first baseball diamond were by Alexander Doubleday in Cooperstown, New York. Regardless, all over the U.S., baseball leagues sprung up in big cities and little towns alike. It was clear that it was becoming part of the American way of life following the Civil War when the first professional leagues were formed. The appetite for baseball seemed unquenchable, even though these leagues had a lot of problems. They often lasted just a few years and then disbanded to be replaced by new ones. Most were run by volunteers with regular day jobs, and their budgets were always on a shoestring. Here on the Eastern Shore, teams were made up of mostly farm and cannery workers, the two largest industries here at the time. Records show that games were being played in Talbot County in 1866, and that within a year, Easton, St. Michael's, and Trapp had all organized teams. Chestertown had also caught baseball fever by this time. The post-Civil War boom economy, which led to rail lines being completed here on Delmarva, made travel easier for teams to play in a wider circuit of towns. Players were treated like celebrities in every town they visited. They were given parades and special meals in their honor with speeches and music. For overnight trips, they were often hosted in private homes because they couldn't afford to stay in hotels. In the earliest days, even if they were considered professionals, a player considered it high pay if they got $5 a game. Nonetheless, competition to join a team became very stiff. By 1908, the Cambridge Canners had to go through hundreds of applications to fill a 15-slot roster. From the late 1800s on, baseball was an obsession on Delmarva. World War I interrupted the usual summer fun, but once it was over, professional baseball became a serious business. And the Eastern Shore League was first formed in 1922. They managed to stay in business for 6 years with six teams, with all three states on the peninsula represented. From Maryland, there were the Cambridge Canners, the Crisfield Crabbers, the Pocomoke City Salamanders, and the Salisbury Indians. Delaware had the Laurel Blue Hens, and from Virginia came the Parksley Spuds. June 12th was opening day for the first season. 6,000 people attended the first game, and Delmarva fans felt like they were in baseball heaven. Unfortunately, with emotions running so high, spectators got out of hand during a game between Crisfield and Parksley. They attacked an umpire for a questionable call, sending him to the hospital with a cracked skull. The season was also marred by the practice of bringing in ringers mid-season from outside the area to improve a team's playoff chances. This was banned in the rules the next year. The new regulation and favorable notice from the big leagues led to athletes from other regions applying for regular positions on our local teams. Famed right fielder and Hall of Famer George Selkirk came all the way from Ontario, Canada, to play for the Cambridge Canners in 1927. There are many star players who grew up right here on Delmarva and who deserve a mention in this story, but there are three Hall of Famers in particular who stand out. The first is Frank Home Run Baker. He was born and raised in Trappe, Maryland. No matter where he played in the outfield or infield, he never really stood out as an asset for his team. His talent was hitting. He went up to the Major League in 1908 and hit a grand slam the very first time he stepped up to plate. He helped the Philadelphia A's win World Series titles in 1910, 1911, and 1913. Rival Yankees manager Hal Chase said that he was, quote, a dangerous man at all times, unquote. Throughout Frank Baker's baseball career, he was known to be a shy man who never had a bad word for anyone. After retiring from active play, he came back to Trappe to live and to scout area teams for the Philadelphia A's. That's when he found the next standout player in our story. Jimmy Fox got his start right out of high school when he was recruited to play for the Easton Farmers. His father, Del, was well known to baseball fans on Delmarva. He could have gone on to bigger things, but stayed on the Eastern Shore to help his family when his own father died suddenly. Jimmy played catcher for the Dover Senators in 1923. His team lost the local pennant to the Parksley Spuds, but they invited him to join them. In the 1924 playoff season, in a five-state series, they won the championship with his help. Frank Baker spotted this talented young man and recruited Jimmy to play for the Phillies, where he became one of the greatest first basemen of all time. In 1925, Fox was only 17 when he went to Fort Myers for his first spring training season. He went on to play for the Boston Red Sox and Chicago Cubs. He won three MVP awards and was featured on the cover of Time magazine. He earned the nicknames of Sudlersville Slugger and Double X, since his name Fox ended with two X's. Jimmy generally had a good relationship with his fans. He once visited a young boy who admired him who was in the hospital sick with tuberculosis. This may sound like a pretty standard thing that celebrities do, but in those days TB was a big deal and considered to be very contagious. Jimmy tried to follow in the footsteps of idols like Babe Ruth, but keeping up with their high living got the best of him. Jimmy was never able to handle his liquor or his money. And, like so many other giant talents before and after him, he waited too long to hang up his hat. This made it hard for him to find work when he finally did. Not long before his premature death at the age of 56, convinced his fame was no longer of any value, he gave away all his awards and memorabilia. On a somewhat sudden impulse, he gave them to Gil Dunn, a fan who had a small shrine dedicated to him in his Sudlersville pharmacy. This trove is now available for baseball lovers to view at the Sudlersville Train Museum. The town also has a statue of Jimmy. And his fame was apparently valuable to Hollywood. The character that Tom Hanks plays in the film A League of Their Own, about the Women's Baseball League during World War II, is based in part on stories about Jimmy Fox.
Are you crying?
No.
Are you crying? Are you crying? There's no crying. There's no crying in baseball.
Why don't you leave her alone, Jimmy?
Oh, you zip it, Doris.
Crying may be frowned upon in baseball, but people do get very emotional about this sport. Obsession for the game led most American towns to create and maintain beautiful ball fields for white players and fans. Until the mid-20th century, baseball, like everything else here, was segregated. The black community had to come up with their own ball fields, and because they had less money, these were usually empty lots or what they simply called clean places, with few amenities. The Eastern Shore Negro League was not formally recognized until 1932. Clearly, devotion to the game was just as strong for blacks as it was for whites. And you can't keep real talent down. That brings us to another local Hall of Famer. The story of baseball on Delmarva would not be complete without talking about William Judy Johnson. Judy was born in Snow Hill, Maryland in 1899. At about the age of 10, his family moved to Wilmington, Delaware to find better job opportunities. His father became the athletic director of the Negro Settlement House there. He was a boxing coach, but Judy had a passion for baseball from an early age. He began playing professionally for the Negro League in 1918. He was a power hitter with a consistently high batting average, and he was an excellent third baseman known to approach that position scientifically with, quote, intelligence and grace, unquote. By the 1920s, many white minor league rookies were starting at $150 a week. Black players were still making about $5 a game. So while he was still a player, Judy gladly became a team manager for the extra money. When Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier in 1947, Judy had retired from active play and had been coaching in the Negro League for some time. Connie Mack, of Phillies fame, invited him to scout for the team. Judy is in the National Baseball Hall of Fame and the Delaware Sports Hall of Fame. His home in Marshalltown, Delaware, is on the National Register of Historic Places. And you can also see a display dedicated to him at the Julia Purnell Museum in his birthplace, Snow Hill. Today, on any given day or evening from spring through early fall, you can catch a live game of baseball here on Delmarva. From boys and girls t-ball to Little League to high school and college ball, to recreation leagues, to the minor league Delmarva Shorebirds and the Wilmington Blue Hens. And though it's not considered the same game, don't discount baseball's exciting close cousins, slow and fast-pitch softball, which both women and men play. Hitting a ball and running the bases is a part of the fabric of our country. To watch a game on a small field where you can hear the players and coaches talking is very different and, in my opinion, more exciting than watching on TV or in a large stadium. Though some teams may play dirty and umps can make bad calls, it always feels good to root for your home team. But when your team loses, buck up and remember,
there's no crying in baseball!
Find out more about Delmarva's baseball heritage by visiting the Eastern Shore Baseball League Museum at Shorebird Stadium in Salisbury. It's open during their regular games. There are also a number of good books on this topic. Find links to these and more on our website, delmarvaalmanac.com/history. And now for some Delmarva dates with history for this time period. One of the largest Indian reservations in our region was surveyed on November 3, 1686. It was called Askimonikansen, and it was on the Pocomoke River west of Snow Hill, Maryland. The property was never recorded officially, so it could not legally belong to the Indians. Several tribes and clans from around the region were forced to live there under very crowded conditions that quickly became untenable. After just a few years, the residents dispersed. Many emigrated north to join the Nanticokes in Oak Orchard, Delaware. And on November 2, 1732, John Dickinson was born in Talbot County, Maryland. Dickinson was elected president of Delaware in 1781 and was one of the framers of the U.S. Constitution, known as its Pen Man. It's time for another break now. When we come back, we'll have Jim Rapp's story about local Rails to Trails projects. Did you know that according to the USDA, 14% of American households did not have a sufficient quantity of affordable, nutritious food for at least part of 2014? Please consider giving generously to your local food bank regularly throughout the year. Visit our website for links for your state, delmarvaalmanac.com/hunger. Welcome back to the Delmarva Almanac. I'm Dana Kester McCabe, and I'm glad you're spending a little of your day with us. The cool, crisp nights of November are perfect for stargazing on Delmarva. On the 11th, the northern Taurid meteor showers will peak. We'll have another supermoon when it's full on the 14th. And on the 17th, the Leonid meteor showers will peak. Now here's naturalist Jim Rapp to tell us about some great options for fall hiking.
Railroads have a long and storied history on Delmarva. Starting in the 1820s, railroads were constructed to deliver fresh produce and seafood to cities up and down the East Coast, from our mainland farm communities and seaside and bayside villages. Coal and other commodities were delivered to the peninsula to heat our homes and fuel our industries. Later in the 1800s, passenger trains brought urban vacationers to our beach resorts, which was the beginning of a new tourism economy. Many of Delmarva's small towns and large cities prospered during the railway boom. But by the early 1900s, the railroads began to fail as modern trucking systems were developed and commercial seafood harvests decreased. A 1933 hurricane destroyed the railway bridge to Ocean City, effectively ending the era of Delmarva's passenger trains. The shift from traveling on train tracks to highways and skyways was occurring nationwide. Left behind were miles and miles of unused railroad lines connecting small-town America to the big cities. In the mid-1960s, an idea was born to convert abandoned railways into public trails. No one person can claim this innovative concept. As steel tracks were ripped out and scrapped, people just naturally started hiking and exploring the old railroad paths. As more and more communities took to these new non-motorized pathways, the movement became known as Rails to Trails. By the early 1980s, the railroad industry was abandoning up to 8,000 miles of lines each year. In 1983, a group of hiking and biking enthusiasts, railroad buffs, and conservation groups began meeting informally in Washington, D.C., to mobilize efforts to preserve railroad corridors for public use. The group realized the need for an organization that focused specifically on this work, and in 1986, the Rails to Trails Conservancy opened its doors. Today, rail trails are making a significant mark in the healthy lifestyles and tourism economies of American communities, with more than 21,000 miles of rail trails serving tens of millions of people each year. Some of Delmarva's unused rail lines have been converted to trails for hiking and biking, including one spectacular trail that runs from Lewis to Rehoboth Beach along the western edge of Cape Henlopen State Park. Known as the Junction and Breakwater Trail, it gets its name from the former Penn Central Rail Line that ran between Lewis and Rehoboth in the mid-1800s and delivered passengers to the resorts along the Atlantic coast. Penn Central abandoned the line in the early 1970s. This wide, crushed stone rail trail opened in 2003 and originally consisted of a 3.5-mile trail that extended from West Rehoboth northward to Wolf Glade. The trail dead-ended there until 2007 when a 2.5-mile extension was added. Recently, another stretch was added along Freeman Highway, bringing the total distance of the Junction and Breakwater Trail to 7.5 miles of non-vehicular pathway. You can park at the trailhead on Wolf Glade Road or the Holland Glade parking lot behind the Tanger outlets along busy Route 1. As all good trails do, the Junction and Breakwater offers sanctuary from the nearby bustling beach towns and shopping areas. The flat, crushed stone and asphalt trail is suitable for bikes, strollers, and wheelchairs. The rail trail winds through beautiful hardwood and pine forests, open fields, and coastal marshes. The trail includes an 80-foot-long railroad bridge originally built in 1913 that crosses Holland Glade and provides a distant view of a World War II observation tower located near the beach. The tower is one of several from Fort Miles on the Delaware coast that were used to triangulate defense guns during World War II. Soldiers would take readings from offshore targets, which would be radioed back and turned into coordinates. Massive guns hidden in the sand dunes could fire shells up to 25 miles away in the direction of patrolling Nazi ships, which were located by soldiers perched atop the observation towers. Interpretive signs along the Junction and Breakwater Trail provide opportunities to learn about Sussex County history and the plants and wildlife of the Delaware coast. One bird you're likely to encounter while biking or hiking along the rail trail is the red-tailed hawk, one of Delmarva's most common large birds of prey. Red tails have broad, rounded wings that span 4 feet and a body length of around 2 feet from head to tail. Their coloration is brownish on the back, with a buffy white belly and breast. Their name is derived from the reddish-brown colored tail, which can be seen easily without binoculars when these raptors are soaring on a sunny day. The red-tailed hawk is often spotted hovering and circling on thermal updrafts above open fields and marshes near the forest. They do most of their hunting either soaring or by watching from a high perch, such as a tall tree, telephone pole, or streetlight. When an unsuspecting animal is spotted, they swoop in to capture their prey in powerful talons. Small animals, such as mice and voles, are usually carried back to the perch, but large prey, such as rabbits, are partially eaten on the ground. Courting red-tailed hawks put on a thrilling display. The male will soar in wide circles to extreme heights and then plummet in a steep dive and then shoot back up again. After showing off for a bit, he approaches the female from above and touches her briefly with his feet. The courting pair will occasionally clasp talons and spiral to the ground together before pulling away and swooping up to safety. Rail trails, such as the Junction and Breakwater, offer us incredible opportunities to experience nature and explore history. Trails improve our quality of life by offering a safe place to exercise and spend time with family and friends outdoors. Delaware officials estimate that 50,000 people use the Junction and Breakwater Trail each year, and many of them are tourists who spend money in the hotels, restaurants, and shops in Lewis and Rehoboth Beach. There are many more miles of abandoned railway lines on the Delmarva Peninsula. Imagine if just a few sections of these old rails could be converted to trails, just like the Junction and Breakwater, that could connect our towns the way that railroads did a century ago. Delmarva communities would benefit greatly from improved quality of life, increased spending through tourism, and new health and fitness opportunities. Former rail towns can become trail towns and prosper again in the 21st century.
Thanks, Jim. Don't forget daylight savings time ends tonight. That will make hiking at sunrise a little easier for we early birds. But only if we set our clocks to fall back 1 hour before bed tonight. And finally, if you love wildlife, check out the 6th Annual Wild and Scenic Film Festival at Secrets in Ocean City on Thursday, November 17th at 6 p.m. Watch 16 short nature films ranging from the sublime to the ridiculous, while enjoying drinks and discounted food selections. Proceeds from this event will benefit the Assateague Coastal Trust's efforts to protect our environment. Tickets are $20 in advance and $25 at the door. Find out about this and other events on our website, delmarvaalmanac.com/events. Well, that's all for this edition of the Delmarva Almanac. Be sure to follow us on Facebook or Twitter, and next week join us to learn more about our local culture and get connected to our natural wonders. We'd like to thank our community partners, the Friends of Delmarva Public Radio, and our underwriters for their help in bringing this program to you, our audience. If you'd like to become an underwriter for this program, visit delmarvaalmanac.com/support. Our theme music was provided by Brightside Studio. This show has been a Moonshell production. Thanks for listening. Until we meet again, may the rhythms and tides of Delmarva bring you good fortune.